For the first time in nearly 30 years, the Irish Blood Transfusion Service is having to import a consignment of blood from the UK. I'm joined now on the line to discuss this by Chief Executive of the IBTS, Orla O'Brien. Orla, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
What has created this situation that we haven't had to encounter since the early 90s?
And I guess the answer is a very simple one, Ciara. The events of the last 15 months, since the COVID pandemic, we too in the IBTS had to change how we worked. So previously you would have been able to walk into any clinic whenever they were in town and donated blood. However, since the pandemic started, we had to introduce an appointment system, which was very good in one sense in that it allowed us to be able to choose and place an emphasis if we were lower in a particular blood group, we could target different people and so on. And while our donors have been absolutely exceptional and we did not run short of blood at any point during the pandemic, I guess in recent weeks it has become a bit more difficult to get people into clinics. That is because of, obviously, we've public health restrictions that are now easing. It's summertime, the Euros are on, people are going on holidays and so on. And as a result, that has simply caused us to be a little lower than what we would like in certain blood groups. We looked at various ways that we could address this, and we certainly are doing lots of things like increasing our clinics, running more Sunday clinics and so on. But we did want to import a small amount. We felt that was the safest thing to do because we do not want to cause any knock-on effect for hospitals. And we're very aware of that. It's already been a difficult enough time for the last 15 months. We didn't want a blood shortage to be added to that, and hence the decision to import the consignment today.
On an average week, Orla, how many units of blood does Ireland need?
So every week we need to collect at least 3,000 units, and that usually, we're very lucky in Ireland, we've got donors who are very committed and very loyal. However, I think what we've seen is the demand in the last number of weeks has been extremely high. Now, in the main, we can balance that demand very well, and we're well used to doing that. However, some of our blood groups are ones that we need a lot for a lot of patients. They're ones that would be used more than others, and that's where we're just experiencing a bit of the shortage at the moment.
And it's those blood groups specifically that you've come to an arrangement with the UK to deliver a consignment. I think they're coming from Manchester. And
yes.
They're O negative, A negative and B negative. And as you say, they're the most frequently used. How are stocks of other blood groups?
Yeah, they're all okay. We monitor them obviously all of the time, and we plan for that every day. So that's quite a dynamic thing. For blood groups such as O negative, that's a very even though it's quite a rare blood group, it is a blood group that can be transfused to any patient. Mm. So therefore, it is one that, despite it being a relatively small proportion of the population, it is one of the ones that's used most. So therefore, in Ireland at the moment, we have about 3% of our population are blood donors, and approximately 9% of that the population who donate are O negative. So it's quite a small pool that we're pulling from all of the time. And hence it tends to be, it's not just in Ireland, this would be across Europe and globally, it tends to be the group that's under the most pressure. And hence that's the group that we're also getting a supply of today. And that's just to increase our baseline stocks so that we don't fall too low.
Orla, you were saying that around 3% of the population donate blood regularly. How does that compare to our counterparts, for example, in Europe?
So it's not too bad, it's not too good. I mean, we're at the lower end of normal. I think generally about 6% of the population in other countries globally, the evidence would be about 6% would be donors. In Ireland, it's 3%. That is something that we know we need to work on. Our donor population tends to be a little bit older, so certainly a big challenge for us moving on from here will be to encourage more of our younger population to become active donors.
And I suppose the one key action that anybody who wishes to donate and can donate can do is the action of donation, and that will prevent, I would imagine, Orla, the IBTS having to seek consignments from the counterparts in the UK and elsewhere. What do you imagine are the barriers that people feel they may encounter?
Well, I think one of the obvious one around is just the availability. Is there does there happen to be a clinic near them when they want to donate? Certainly in previous times, before COVID, it would have been quite a delay if you were donating in your local area, say in Kildare, for example. It may be that you would go along and you could be waiting for quite some time, and that could put some people off. With the appointment system, you will now be guaranteed you will get in and out pretty much within the hour. I donated blood myself yesterday, and I was in and out within the hour. So from that sense, that barrier should hopefully no longer be there.
And actually, Orla, anybody that I've spoken to that's donated blood since the beginning of the pandemic actually loves the new system.
Yeah, for sure. I think we've all got used to not just showing up to anywhere anymore. As a result of COVID, we're all more used to now making an appointment before we go. And it's no different in the blood transfusion service. We too have to make sure that you're well enough to donate. We have a duty of care not only to make sure we've safe blood, but to make sure that we care for our donor, and also make sure that we give the best blood to patients. So it's very important to us that our donors are well and that they're well enough to attend. So we do have criteria and a series of questions that we need to ask donors before that we can allow them to come and donate. And a lot of that, unfortunately, in today's world relates to COVID as well. So for example, if you've been lucky enough to have your COVID vaccine, we won't take blood from you for at least 7 days after that. And that has been part of the issue in recent weeks, is when you get you may have your appointment already made to donate blood, but in the meantime you get your call for your vaccine, and of course you must go for your vaccine, and that absolutely is the priority, and hence you might then have to cancel your blood donation. And that's in part has been a factor in the last number of weeks, and some of the challenges in terms of getting people into clinics.
Well, speaking of clinics, there's a 4-day clinic taking place in Naas beginning on Monday. It's being held in the Monreed Community Centre Woodlands Avenue in Naas. And as Orla, you've been very clear in pointing out, you do have to make an appointment. And the number on which to do so is 1850 731 137. And I'll give that number out again before the end of the programme. And Orla, what would you say to people who've never given blood before but are strongly considering so doing now?
We would encourage everybody that if you are a first-time donor, we would love to hear from you. What we do need you to do, however, I think you're right, it's important. We can't say to anyone just to drop into a clinic. That option is just simply not open to us anymore for the obvious reasons. So if anybody is interested in giving blood for the first time, we would ask you to go on to giveblood.ie. There is an eligibility quiz, and there are just some questions that you need to be aware of before you give blood and need to make sure that you can answer, and then register your interest to donate, and then somebody from the Blood Transfusion Service will get back to you. We would ask that you would bear with us. We're doing all of this over the phone, so it might take a little bit of time, so just to bear with us if you don't get a call back immediately. And certainly one of our team would then book an appointment for you, and that first appointment is likely to be a bit longer than your subsequent ones, because there's a bit more details that we need from you at the start, and then you're good to go. And it is important that, I think it's an incredible thing to be able to do, and I've heard a lot of people, I think myself, over the last 15 months saying, gosh, I wish there was something that I could do. Giving blood is one of the things that you can do, because whether we're in a pandemic or whether we're in normal times, we always need blood, without a doubt. As I said earlier, 3,000 units every single week. That hasn't changed because of the pandemic. In fact, if anything, it's more so, because the HSE is trying to get back up and get hospital activity back to normal. So that need never goes away, and it's certainly here. It's just we have to do it a little bit differently in COVID times to make sure our donors stay safe throughout the process.
Well, Orla O'Brien, Chief Executive of the Irish Blood Transfusion Service, thank you indeed for joining us. And that number, if you're in the Naas area, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday or Thursday of next week from around 3:45, and you would like to make an appointment to donate blood, you can give a call on 1850 731 137. 1850 731 137.
Want to get into
now? Enables, which is an EU-funded research group coordinated by UCC's Tyndall National Institute, is issuing a warning that up to 78 million batteries will be dumped every day by 2025 unless the lifespan of batteries powering Internet of Things devices is radically improved. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Mike Hayes. He's head of ICT for energy efficiency at that Tyndall National Institute. Mike, you're very welcome to the programme.
Okay, thank you, Ciara, and thank you for the opportunity to come on your program.
Delighted to prefer it. I suppose with batteries, the historic problem has always been their lifespan, and I suppose we're reaching a pinch point with that now. And in general, unless they're rechargeable, their lifetime ideally should be the same lifetime as that of the device, or near as enough as makes no difference.
Yeah. And I mean, no matter where you look, no matter what scale you're at, there's a problem with batteries. I mean, you look at, you know, the problems we have, the national grid, you know, storage of renewable energies, all the way down to the tiny devices that we're talking about, these Internet of Things devices, tiny sensors that we would put in our clothing, in our shoes, in our houses, in our factories, and so on. They have exactly the same problems, that the lifetime of the device that's typically sensing information and sharing it is going to be less than the battery life is going to be too short, and we have to find ways to make these batteries last longer. And so, that's what our Enables project is all about.
So what is the fundamental problem with battery lifetime and lifespan that seems to affect all batteries?
Yeah, I think it's simply an energy budgeting issue that, you know, no matter how simple we make the device, for example, for the devices we're talking about, we have to shrink them to incredibly small sizes, typically, which means there's very little room left for the battery. And that means then that we have to find ways to, number one, minimize the power consumption of the device, and then we need to find ways to extend the battery life where possible. And one of the big innovations here that we're looking at is this concept of energy harvesting. Now, I think energy harvesting should be familiar to most people. You think of, you know, wind turbines, solar panels, and so on. But what we're doing is we're doing this at tiny, tiny levels, which actually is a big challenge because, you know, we might have plenty of space out in our gardens or on our rooftops to get our solar energy. But, for example, if we want to use light energy for these devices, very often the devices are indoors with very low lighting levels, and the lighting levels are going to be probably about 2% of that you get outdoors. So, number one, the lack of the ambient energies that's available to us. And number two, the limited space that we have to harvest and indeed to store that energy and then to use it. I mean, the other types of energies we have in are what we call thermoelectric energy. So this is converting things like body heat to electricity.
Yeah.
And also vibrations, you know, if people are walking or running, or if you've got a machine that's running, the actual vibration from the machine can be converted into electricity. And that's one of the big innovations we're looking at.
This sounds like an enormously technical, but from a scientific perspective, enormously satisfying problem to try to encounter.
Yeah, I mean, it's satisfying to bring together the ecosystem that's required. And as you have correctly asserted, this is a very complex problem. It's not just about, you know, designing a solar panel or some sort of thermoelectric device and making it work. One of the big challenges we see here is that we need to bring together everybody. We need to find ways to minimize the power consumption of these devices. We need to understand, are there tiny amounts of these ambient energies, you know, vibrations, heat, indoor solar energy available to us? How can we successfully grasp those and convert these to electricity and make the battery last longer? And we don't need to make it last indefinitely. The trick really is to make it outlast the device that's powering. So if the device needs to run for, you know, 5 years or 10 years, how do we extend the battery life, you know, for that life?
And would it be reasonable to assume, Mike, that if you crack that problem on the scale of the very small devices that we're talking about here, it's theoretically possible to scale up that resolution for larger devices and larger batteries?
Yeah, there's a phrase that we use in the world of kind of powering the Internet of Things and energy harvesting, and unfortunately the term is, it depends.
It depends on the kind of device and what you're going to use it for.
Exactly, yeah. And I think one of the tricks here is you need to understand the application. So in many cases, yes, the technology that we're developing can actually be scaled. And in fact, it gets easier as more space is available to you. In fact, the biggest problem we have is that as we continually shrink things, it becomes harder and harder to make use of the limited space that's available to us. And also, how do we gain access to these vibrations? How do we gain access to this heat energy? If the device is embedded in our clothes, or indeed it's even implanted in our bodies, or it's, you know, it's embedded in the infrastructure of our walls and so on, how on earth are we going to gain access to these ambient energies, and how are we going to convert them to electricity?
It certainly is a significant problem, but there does seem to be some kind of light at the end of that theoretical tunnel. Mike Hayes, Head of ICT for Energy Efficiency at the Tyndall National Institute, thank you indeed for joining us there. Coming up after the break, Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble talks to the reporter who's just spoken with Ian Bailey in advance of the release of the Netflix documentary on Sophie Toscan-Duplantier, and we'll hear about Kildare's septic tanks. Netflix is releasing today its much publicised documentary on Sophie Toscan-Duplantier, and Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble has been speaking to a reporter at thejournal.ie, Niall O'Connor, who spoke with Ian Bailey ahead of the release today of that documentary.
At the moment, what we're dealing with, I suppose, is that there's two documentaries now out, but this all began in Skull in West Cork in 1986. In fact, December 23rd, Sophie Toscan-Duplantier was a French woman who had a holiday home in a place near Tumor, just outside Skull, very picturesque area overlooking, we'll say, Fastnet Rock and the broad Atlantic. I suppose Sophie would have been known in France as a documentary maker, and she had significant connections, we'll say, to the French film industry. She had been in her holiday home in Skull, and at some point on December 23rd in 1996, she was attacked near her home and murdered by someone. No one has ever been prosecuted for that. No one has ever been charged for that crime. And essentially, these documentaries are now telling, I suppose, the world, really, about that horrendous and horrific crime.
And as you say, these documentaries, because there's a couple that are out currently. Netflix 3-part doc just landed this morning, I believe. And then Sky TV, they also have a documentary at the moment with the director, Jim Sheridan. Is this a coincidence that the two documentaries are coming out at a similar time?
Well, whether it's a coincidence or not, I suppose it's something that, for whatever reason, these two documentary makers have grasped this this story. Now, one aspect of this clearly is the recent prosecution of Ian Bailey, a British national who was living in the area, for the alleged murder of Sophie Toscan-Duplantier. Now, let me caveat this with, you know, Ian Bailey has never been charged with the murder in Ireland. He has never been prosecuted here in Ireland. He will absolutely 100% say that he had nothing to do with this, and has pleaded for people to understand that he is innocent of this crime in Ireland. And in fairness, you know, he has never been charged. He certainly has been arrested in Ireland in relation to it, but there's been no charges. The EPP didn't progress with the case here. But French authorities took their own prosecution following a campaign by Sophie's family in France, and Mr. Bailey was found guilty by a French court of that murder in France, using unique law that allows a French court to prosecute someone for the offence over here.
Just to go to your article, Niall, you actually spoke with Mr. Bailey, and one of the things he said to you was he was totally sympathetic to the French family. That's in quotes in your article. He said that from the outset there was a degree of light feckery going on with the Netflix project. That's another quote. Was he directly contacted by Netflix?
Yeah, he gave interviews. We spoke at length to him yesterday, and we went through the issue. And what he says is that he's not happy with the Netflix project. He says that he wants his interviews withdrawn from the Netflix project. He says that he's called it, and we quoted him this morning in the journal, saying that he believes that it's demonising propaganda. He believes that the documentary is a kind of a one-sided telling of the story. As I said, he has said that he is innocent of this crime, and, you know, he hasn't been charged in Ireland. So that's what his belief is.
Now, he, again, in quotes, in the article said that the allegation, I guess, or the charges, or what people think about him in general, is a stinking lie that was perpetuated from day one. Why does he believe he was targeted, if that's how he sees things?
Yeah, like, I suppose Ian Bailey believes that, essentially, he alleges that Gardaí targeted him. They had pinned this murder on him, and that he believes that it was, you know, to use the colloquial term, a stitch-up. Clearly, you know, the Gardaí would deny that, but that, you know, as he has said time and again, down through the years since 1996, that, you know, there's no evidence to progress this, and he has denied that he had any involvement in it. But he is saying that the state has gone after him. Now, to be fair to the state hasn't charged him with an offence. The EPP decided that it couldn't progress, and that's his position.
He did note that he watched the Sky documentary, again in quotes here. He said to you, "It made me cry, it really upset me." He said that he couldn't obviously finish the series or the episodes. Then he also goes on to note that he's experienced so much loss. He again in quotes said, "I've lost everything that I held the value of. I lost my career. I've lost 25 years of legitimate expectation. And now Jules has decided our journey together has ended." He has recently broken up with his partner. It seems as if he was greatly affected by watching the Sky documentary.
Yeah, Jim Sheridan made it. An exceptional filmmaker is Jim Sheridan, and he said that he sat down, it's a five-parter, but he said that he sat down and he watched two episodes of it, and he said that he couldn't watch any more of it because it had upset him. Look, clearly, I mean, you know, talking to Mr. Bailey, it is quite evident that he has suffered a lot in his life, entirely associated with the murder of Sophie Tuscan de Plantier, and the fact that he's at the centre of what he calls, you know, he says that he's calm in the eye of a hurricane, and that's certainly the way it looks when you speak to him. He is certainly in that kind of eye of a hurricane, looking out at the hurricane as it blows around him. There is also, what he says is that there has been also a lot of an effect on the broader Skull community because of this murder, and the fact that it's never been solved. And that, you know, that he wanted to kind of go to journal.ie to give his side of how his life has been and how this has affected him.
Now, something a bit different from the Netflix documentary, Niall, to Sky's, is that Sophie's son, Pierre-Louis, is involved with the Netflix documentary, and I believe he does give an interview.
Yes, he does. He's cooperated with it. The Sky documentary used archive footage and interviews to tell his side of the story, but he has cooperated with Netflix. As a reporter, down through the years, I've met Sophie's relatives. You know, your heart goes out to them. It is utterly a horrific thing to live with, and Pierre-Louis clearly is very distraught, but he was clearly hugely involved in the French telling of this story in terms of the recent trial, and he wants to get his side across. He wants to tell the story of his mother, and Netflix have said, in fairness to them, that they want to put Sophie front and centre, because I suppose the risk is that the victim, in the throes of all these international geopolitical involvement in this case between French authorities and Irish authorities, that this poor victim, Sophie Tuscan de Plantier, has been somewhat put to the background.
Well, Niall O'Connor, a reporter with thejournal.ie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that was, of course, Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble. Now, the Environmental Protection Agency has released its latest report into septic tanks, and it shows 54% of septic tank systems failed inspection in 2020. That proportion, by coincidence, is also the proportion of septic tanks inspected in Kildare which failed. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Noel Byrne, Programme Manager in the Office of Environmental Enforcement in the EPA. Noel, you're welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
Why are septic tanks inspected?
Well, septic tank inspection, I suppose there's national legislation there around septic tank inspections where the EPA have a role in developing a plan. The local authorities then have to deliver that plan, and they go out then and inspect households across the country. And the plans are focused on the areas, I suppose, of highest risk. That's the boat environment, which would be your water quality typically, and then the human health factor, which would be drinking water well or maybe coming directly in contact with wastewater if it was ponding in your garden.
Now, did the pandemic impact much or at all the number of inspections conducted last year?
Yeah, typically in the plan, there's a minimum of 1,000 inspections required to be completed each year nationally. And last year, there was only 809 inspections. So roughly about 80% of inspections were completed. Local authorities that fell below the numbers of inspections will be looking to do extra inspections in 2022 to catch up, in 2021 to catch up on those inspections. But yeah, they were down because of the pandemic.
I think in Kildare, they may have gone up. I'm open to correction. There were 34 in 2019 and 39 last year. But to put that in context for everybody, I think there are around 1,600 septic tanks in this county. And I imagine the proportion of inspections carried out in any relevant local authority area are a snapshot in statistical terms, Noel, of the respective septic tank populations, if you will, in a given county.
Yeah, Kildare did get all their inspections done last year, so those are one of the counties that got all those done. They are a snapshot, I think, and how the inspections are looked at there is that they're risk-based, so they're targeted to the areas of the greatest environmental risk. So if you look inside at Kildare, you know, where are the rivers that have been impacted by septic tanks, or again, where are the areas that maybe drinking water wells might be vulnerable, and that's where the local authorities will target their inspections that they have. But ultimately, really, a lot of this comes back to the household, and the household is the responsible person to ensure the tank is built and maintained properly. Mm. And there's a few key things that a householder should need to do here. First and foremost, if they have a drinking water well on site as well as a septic tank, they should get their drinking water well tested annually. That's really important. Nationally, there's 160,000 households have their own well and a septic tank on the same site. So it's really key if you have that, just to get that tested each year, get your drinking water well tested each year. Similarly, do a visual check. Go down your garden, particularly in the winter months of the year, and just see, is there any effluent ponding on your garden? Because if anyone comes in contact with that, that can make a meal, or if it's getting into a water course, that can obviously pollute a river then. And then the last thing there is just maybe clean out your system. Typically for a size of tank that any, you know, four-person household would have, you need to clean it out every 3 to 4 years. And lastly then, if you have a failed system, if you had an inspection and your system has failed, you need to get it fixed. There is a grant system available there for householders if you fail an inspection, that you can avail of a grant, and it's up to €5,000 that's available for people. So you should look at that if you have a problem, to bring that to resolution.
And I suppose really to underscore the responsibility of householders here, because it is your septic tank system on your land servicing your house. 433 of the systems that failed inspection last year were because they were not built or maintained properly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose people have to realise, you know, particularly if you're drinking water well, it's you putting your own family at risk potentially, or maybe your neighbour's health at risk, and it's maybe that stream that runs past your house or into a local community if it's polluting that. So there are real risks, and if you have a problem, and the report did identify there's a little less than 500 cases nationally where problems have been there for over 2 years and haven't been resolved. You know, what we're calling it today, that householders that have those problems, obviously they need to get them fixed, and the local authority needs to engage with those people to make sure they're brought to resolution.
And I suppose in a worst case scenario, Noel, the net effect of not attending to any defects in your septic tank and having perhaps some kind of catastrophic collapse is irrevocable pollution either of your drinking water if you take from a private well or of local water courses.
Yeah, if your system's not working properly, you will see it coming out someplace, so it'll either pond underground or it'll leak to a water course. But if you leave your system unmaintained, you run the risk then of having problems. I think the challenge with a lot of this is a lot of septic tanks are down at the bottom of the garden, and people maybe don't go down to that end of the garden that often because they know the septic tanks down there. I stay away from that part of it. But really, you're better off knowing, and if there is an issue, you're better off resolving it.
And over the span of several years, Noel, is have we improved in terms of septic tank inspection performance, disimproved, or is it kind of an uneven keel?
It's actually the same figure has been nearly detected year on year, which is concerning. And as I say, the older ones that are not getting resolved, you know, we need to bring those to resolution because you do not want that figure to keep getting bigger and bigger. And some of those are the problem cases that need to be resolved. But effectively, people aren't really addressing them or checking them themselves to have those issues. And that's why you're seeing the same kind of failure rate kind of being picked up year on year. But that responsibility does need to come back to the household and say, God, do I have a problem here? And if I do, I need to get it fixed.
Well, Noel Byrne, Programme Manager in the Office of Environmental Enforcement at the EPA, thank you indeed for joining us. And as Noel pointed out, grants of up to €5,000 are available to householders who need to carry out repairs on their septic tanks. Now, we got a message into us here on 0833 97 97 97 and texter, I would love to read it out, but it seems that you're having a bit of a problem with your predictive text, because it means that a lot of words have been auto-filled. I can get the gist of what you're trying to tell us, and I would love to share that with all of us here. So if you can, please send it in to us again, 0833 97 97 97. The Irish Heart Foundation has today released very startling new data on the very steep increase in the number of people on waiting lists for cardiac rehabilitation. It's gone up by 54% since 2013. I'm joined on the line now by Medical Director of the Irish Heart Foundation, Dr. Angie Brown. Angie, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi, Ciara, thanks.
For people who may not be familiar, what is cardiac rehabilitation?
So cardiac rehabilitation is an essential component, really, of secondary prevention after you've had a heart attack or sometimes a stroke, you've had heart failure, an angioplasty or a bypass. And there's four phases. Phase one is in hospital, where you're informed about your medication, what's happened to you, what the surgery you've had, treatment you've had. Then phase two is a phone call when you leave hospital, or perhaps an individual or group education session telling you to have a healthier diet, advice about physical activity, stopping smoking and so on. And then phase three, which is the thing we're really talking about, is an exercise and education program which can last between 6 to 12 weeks. You usually would visit the center 2 or 3 times each week, where you'd have various members of staff discussing your exercise program, how to stop smoking if you smoke, give you advice on medication, dealing with stress, and so on. So it's very much a multidisciplinary team that look after you, and there's also support from other patients in the same boat. And then there's a kind of a phase four of staying healthy, where there's support for that as well. So it's quite complex, but we know that cardiac rehabilitation is very cost-effective, very beneficial. It reduces mortality by around 20%, and it reduces hospital readmissions by 18 to 25%, improves patients' quality of life, helps people get exercising again, and helps people return to work. So it's really very beneficial in lots of different ways for patients.
I would imagine, Angie, the delivery of this kind of rehab would take quite a complex team of specialists.
It does indeed, and usually there's a cardiac nurse specialist who is a key role in coordinating people. And then you have dietitians, psychologists, physiotherapists, might have occupational therapists, pharmacists would go through the medication. So there's a different team who would have input at different times, but it would be coordinated by a cardiac nurse specialist.
And why then has there been such a sharp increase in a relatively short space of time, Angie? 54% increase in waiting lists since 2013.
Yeah, so that's kind of, again, multifactorial. partly there's been a significant increase in referrals, which is good because we know the benefit of this. But then there's been a 40% decrease in staffing over the last few years, and that's because nurses have been redeployed. When people have left or retired, they haven't been replaced. So, you know, there's something like... And there's no hospital, I don't think, that has a full team in place. And 33 different centres have lost four key personnel for their cardiac rehab services. So it's very difficult to provide a comprehensive service with that. And then, of course, COVID hit, and every service, of course, was affected. And 77% of all cardiac rehab closed down for at least 12 weeks. And although they did offer some... telehealth and outreach, you know, that was a difficult time as well, as it was for most services. So this has led to this increased waiting list. So there's nearly 3,000 people waiting now, which is a lot.
It does seem, on the face of it, and again, I'm not a member of the HSE, but that the redeployment and the lack of replacement of staff members on existing teams, given that it's so widespread in every unit across the country, is that de facto policy?
I don't think that's de facto policy. I think everyone's been struggling during COVID in particular.
But if it's been happening, Angie, since 2013, that staff are redeployed or if they leave, not replaced, exacerbated then by the challenges of the pandemic. I mean, the seven years between 2013 and the beginning of the pandemic.
Yes, of course. And as you know, there is an HSE embargo on staff employment. I think that's gone now, but it's actually very hard to get qualified staff. And unfortunately, cardiac rehabilitation, even though it's been shown to be very cost-effective, has been the poor cousin, you know, and staff are so desperately needed in other areas of the hospital that it's kind of missed out because no one has been sort of shouting about how important this is and how beneficial it is in terms of reducing hospital admissions, so reducing the burden on the hospital by doing that. And I would hope that, you know, the National Heart Program is looking into that now, and there's a special clinic advisory group who are looking into that, and there is some funding for some community cardiac rehab, but we also need to re-employ or, you know, get new people into all of the rehab teams that are missing them. For instance, if we employed another one to two people in each of the rehab groups at the moment, then they could see an extra 3,000 people a year. So that would wipe out the waiting list, and it would mean that we could actually see people in a timely fashion, because the other problem now is that people are waiting a long time for the cardiac rehabilitation. Mm. Some people may be seen within a month, but more often it's 3 months, and for some places it's over a year. So at that point, you've missed the boat. You know, any benefit really is going to be significantly decreased. You need to get people within 4 weeks of going home from hospital to really see the benefit in the reduction in mortality and readmission to hospital. So we need to get rid of the waiting list so that we can see people in a timely fashion in these units.
What's your sense, Angie, on the net effect of patients? And I know that, you know, these 3,000 people are individuals and their cases will be specific to them, but I would imagine there's a generality of experience. But the net effect upon them of not being able to access this rehab in a timely fashion?
I think there's lots of different aspects for different patients. Some find the anxiety and the stress of having an event like this without the support very difficult, finding it difficult to get back to work. Others don't understand why they're on this medication, and some people even stop their medication too soon, and this can lead to patients re-presenting with a second heart attack because they don't understand the importance of their medication. So it does lead to a potential increase in hospital admissions, potentially further infarcts, further events, potentially an increase in mortality for some of these patients. So it could have serious consequences for some patients.
And do you have any confidence that the programs that you mentioned there, the National Heart Program, will have a positive impact in reducing the waiting list, or certainly improving the lot of those upon that waiting list in any kind of short-term time frame?
I hope so. And I think there is some funding there offer cardiac rehabilitation in the community, but it's not really sufficient. So I'm hoping that the advisory group will be able to assess the need in more detail and then implement these changes. It's always very difficult. We provide these documents and then there's always a big gap to implementation. So we'll just have to keep the pressure up and hopefully then it will be implemented and we can improve the situation, because we have had a world-class cardiac rehabilitation service in the past, and it's very good now, but it's just struggling, and you know, it's struggling, and we need to put it back in place.
Dr. Angie Brown, Medical Director of the Irish Heart Foundation, thank you indeed for joining us.